Support for WKAR is provided by MSU Alumni Association, offering opportunities for networking, alumni enrichment, and community involvement with MSU alumni in your area and across the country. alumni.msu.edu. And by the Lansing State Journal, offering up-to-date news and information 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, on your phone, your tablet, and online at lsj.com.
It's Current State on WKAR. Welcome back. A reminder to look for WKAR's Peter Wharf this evening at the East Lansing Summer Solstice Jazz Festival. WKAR is a proud sponsor of that event. We have been for a number of years. It's always a really good time. It's the semi-official kickoff of the summer season here in our community, and a lot of people enjoy it. And if you can't actually attend for whatever reason, Peter will be broadcasting there live. So you'll hear a lot of the music being performed here on 90.5 FM later on this evening. Keep that in mind. Friday is here. Governor Rick Snyder is calling on state Senate Republicans to return to Lansing. That's after the Senate adjourned for its summer recess without voting on a Medicaid expansion bill under the new federal health care law. The Michigan Public Radio Network's Rick Pluta tells us how the episode left hard feelings and dimming prospects for extending health coverage to many thousands of low-income working households.
The relentlessly positive Governor Snyder was plainly frustrated as he lashed out at his fellow Republicans in the Senate for leaving without approving the Medicaid expansion.
Take a vote, not a vacation.
Governor Snyder had cut short a trade mission to Israel to return to Lansing in hopes the gesture and a personal appeal would change the outcome. Instead, the negotiations collapsed, if they ever actually started. That's after a bipartisan coalition of votes got the measure through the state house last week. The governor says that was a tough vote for many Republicans to support enacting a part of Obamacare, and it appeared there was a deal for Senate Republicans to follow suit. But that was never the case, says Senate Majority Leader Randy Richardville.
It's not really a responsible thing to say, take a vote, not a vacation, when we are the deliberative body and are going to take a hard look on something.
Richardville says a state Senate committee and a work group will spend the summer to try and develop something Republicans there can support. But Governor Snyder says waiting until the Senate returns in August is too late. The governor says his plan is to harness public opinion to get the Senate to act in the next 15 to 20 days.
I don't view it as insignificant that I'm standing here in a press conference asking 10 million people to bug the living daylights out of their senator until they come vote on something.
But Tea Party groups and other conservative organizations say they won't be quiet during that period either. Scott Hagerstrom with Americans for Prosperity says his organization will back lawmakers who oppose the expansion.
They were quite brave. They stood up to their own Republican governor and did the right thing. And you have to give my hats off to them. A lot of respect to those Republican senators.
This is now largely a fight between conservatives who say Republicans should not cooperate with enacting Obamacare and Republicans who say it's now the law of the land and it's time to make the best of it. James Haveman is the director of the State Department of Community Health and the cabinet official responsible for implementing the Medicaid expansion. He says time isn't growing short, it's practically run out, and there's a lot at stake. It would cut in half the number of uninsured people in Michigan who rely on emergency rooms for health care.
And the whole idea is to move health care from a curative model so people don't wait till they got stage 4 cancer, but to be involved in preventive care and get engaged with a physician and start working on chronic conditions. I mean, 70% of the health costs in the state are related to chronic conditions. We can do better than that.
One of the frustrations for Haveman and Governor Snyder is there were apparently enough votes in the Senate to pass the Medicaid expansion. If all 12 Senate Democrats went along, it would only take 8 Republicans to get it passed. But the Michigan Senate, like the state house, operates under a rule that requires more than half the members of the majority party, Republicans in this case, to agree to put a question up for a vote. With rare exceptions, legislation otherwise languishes. The governor said this was an instance where the rule should have been set aside.
Shouldn't the Constitution say once a party wins the majority of a chamber, why do you even bother having the other people show up? It doesn't say that.
Snyder is one of a handful of Republican governors across the nation who've tussled with their GOP legislators on Medicaid. In Arizona, Governor Jan Brewer carried through on a threat to veto all legislation sent to her desk until the legislature there adopted a Medicaid expansion that she signed into law this week. Governor Snyder's strategy is to hope enough constituents will ruin enough senators' summer breaks to get them back to Lansing. For the Michigan Public Radio Network, I'm Rick Pluta at the state capitol.
Current State turns now to another story coming from the Michigan state capitol. The Sixth Amendment to the U.S. Constitution makes it clear any citizen accused of a crime will, if necessary, have access to qualified legal representation in court. Yet for years in Michigan, many have said this access has been inconsistent at best and woefully inadequate at worst. Finally, after decades of failed efforts to reform the system, both the state Senate and House sent bipartisan bills on Wednesday to Governor Snyder's desk that would offer some concrete changes. Joining us to help sort out what these bills will mean for Michigan's indigent defense system is Tom Boyd, Chief Judge for the 55th District Court here in Ingham County, who's been an advocate for reform. Welcome back to the program, Judge Boyd.
Thank you very much. It's nice to be back.
We spoke at length about this when you were on Current State back in early May, but for listeners who are new to the issue, can you first tell us how Michigan's public defender system has worked for the past few decades?
Really, since the Constitution was passed in 1963, Michigan has had not had one system, it's had many systems. Each individual county, each individual circuit, each individual district has its own way of providing legal representation for those who cannot afford it. And it's led to sort of this patchwork quilt. Some programs operate well and others don't. On a national standard, the American Bar Association has developed 10 principles to guide a system for providing indigent defense. There's not one system in Michigan that meets all 10 principles. Mm. So what we have is, while we have well-meaning people working hard in a dysfunctional system, we don't have the systemic safeguards in place to assure that each individual defendant receives the effective assistance of counsel that the Constitution calls for.
As a supporter of reform, in your view, how bad is it? I mean, last time you told some pretty eye-opening accounts.
Well, just to remind your listeners a couple of those, we have a situation where today, in the majority, the vast majority, almost all circuits, it's the judge presiding over the case, or the judges of that circuit, who decide which lawyers get to work, which lawyers get to have the cases, which creates a conflict of interest in the lawyer's mind between the zealous representation and effective representation required by the Constitution and not wanting to anger the court and potentially lose their contract. Sometimes zealous representation requires being aggressive and filing motions that might clog up the court's docket. And today that conflict results in probably not zealous representation, which is required by the canons and the Constitution, the rules and the Constitution. So we need to get rid of that conflict. For example, I was at a meeting over a year ago with a number of judges in a specific county talking about indigent defense and emphasizing that one of the things we need to do is to separate the appointment process from the judges themselves. And one of the judges in the room said to me, well, wait a minute, if I don't get to appoint my lawyers, how will I fund my campaign? Mm. So we've deteriorated to the point where we really have sort of a corrupt system that people are trapped in, and we need to free them so that the system has safeguards for the defendants rather than fundraising opportunities for elected officials.
I guess so. So two bills will combine to launch a process here aimed at reforming this system. Can you tell us what these bills will actually do?
Sure, and I love the word launch because this is really not the end of a debate. It's the beginning.
The legislature and the governor will have to weigh in here. We're talking about legislation to make these changes possible.
It's true. Right? The legislature, the bills you mentioned, will create a permanent commission. And this commission will search the country, the world and find what are the minimum standards for a system to provide effective assistance to counsel. And those standards will be adopted by this commission after public hearings. They'll be sent to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court will validate those principles, those standards, and then each community will be asked how they plan to implement the standards within their community. Michigan is a very unique beast because in so many things, whether it's school districts or police departments, local control is a fundamental principle in Michigan governance. So what this bill does is preserve local control while mandating minimum state standards.
I see. There was little resistance to these forms in these legislative votes this week, but it wasn't unanimous either. Do you know where resistance is coming from and how that resistance is being justified? Is this a cost issue or what?
I think there's a variety of things. First, I think that's an excellent opportunity for me to identify the individuals who made this happen. I think that Governor Snyder deserves a lot of credit for bringing this issue back to the forefront and pushing this legislation through. Representative Tom McMillan, Senator Bruce Caswell, these are the individuals who championed these bills through the legislative process. There are a handful of legislators and certainly some people who are going to tell you that the costs is something they're concerned about. I read in the State Journal yesterday that the number $50 million was thrown out there as a potential long-term cost annually of providing effective assistance to people accused of crime who can't otherwise afford a lawyer. And what we have to do is we have to keep these things in perspective. If we think about $50 million, which is a tremendous amount of money, no doubt about that. Well, 15 years ago, when I lobbied for the Department of Attorney General, Attorney General Frank Kelly, $50 million was the amount of money that the Department of Corrections lapsed each year. Lapsed means the residuals in each of their accounts when you add them all up at the end of the year. That was over $50 million. Mm. So in terms of relative scale, $50 million and what we're spending in corrections is money we ought to move to avoiding jailing people who don't need to be jailed. A perfect example is one of the stories I told you last time I was here was about a United States Supreme Court case named Lafler versus Cooper. That's a Detroit case. And the Supreme Court decided that that case needed to be reversed because the trial counsel was ineffective. This is the case where the lawyer told the defendant not to plead guilty to a lesser charge because you couldn't be convicted of attempted murder if you only shot someone below the waist.
Right.
Which, of course, is a preposterous thing to say. Really ineffective assistance of counsel, the Supreme Court said that. If you look at that case and just look at the dollars, the difference in the amount of money that that gentleman would have cost us, the taxpayers, for being wrongfully incarcerated, as determined by the United States Supreme Court. Mm. If he stayed his minimum time in jail, we would have spent $374,000 more than we should have. Mm. If he reached his maximum sentence, on this one individual, we would have spent $748,000 more than we should have. That's one defendant out of tens of thousands of cases per year. So if we have a handful of guys like this that we can put in jail for the right amount of time that the system and the law determines is the appropriate for their crime, we may be saving $750,000 a year per inmate.
How interesting.
So how do you measure what it's – first of all, we don't know what it's going to cost yet. But you have to balance off the cost.
You have to factor instances like that into the landscape.
And when we have a system with no procedural safeguards, there's just no way to tell how many defendants like this are out there costing us, $748,000 for no reason at all.
Yeah. Do you view this as a good start? How encouraged were you by the passage of these measures?
Yeah, I'm very encouraged. I mean, it's not perfect. I think Senator Bruce Caswell has said a number of times that you've got legislation right when no one loves it. And I don't love it, but it's a very good start. I've likened it to if you're on a cruise liner and you're going the wrong direction for 50 years, it's hard to turn a big boat. And that's what this bill does, is it turns the boat around and we're now headed back. But we've got 50 years to head back. So this is not going to be an overnight solution. It's going to be a long process where people of goodwill will have to establish standards and find ways to pay for them. Local communities will be allowed to implement those standards pursuant to local needs and desires. Some communities will do what Muskegon County did recently, and that's open a public defender's office. Some communities will continue contract systems with private lawyers providing this service. But each local community will be able to make those decisions based upon a minimum statewide standard as determined by this commission and accepted by the Michigan State Supreme Court.
If the kinds of reforms suggested by this issue actually take shape, how would that impact the operations in your courtroom? Is there a way that you feel justice would unfold differently than it is now?
Sure. I think there's some changes that are predictable, and I can tell you today, and there's some changes that I can only guess at. The predictable changes are judges will be out of the attorney picking business. I, as a judge, don't have any right to pick who the prosecutor sends to court to prosecute a case. There's no reason for me to have any more right to pick who the defense sends to court. And that, I think, will be something that happens relatively quickly, which means within the next few years. I suspect that this new commission will have a standard that takes judges out of the lawyer-picking business. That's what leads to the corruption, and that needs to end soon.
These ABA 10 principles that you've alluded to a number of times, does that do that? That takes the judges out of the equation.
Principle number one is independence from the judiciary in the ABA's 10 principles.
Yeah.
And your listeners can easily Google ABA 10 principles, and the first site that Google will bring you to is an annotated version of those principles. Number one is independence from the judiciary.
Is there another one that really rises to the top for you? Let's say, what would you put in second in terms of importance?
You know, it's arguable, but for me, I think that to have your lawyer adequately trained and prepared to handle the case is a very important one. Some of the systems, even some of the well-run systems in Michigan today, will allow a lawyer just out of law school to work on a felony case, even a felony case where life in prison is one of the possible outcomes.
Wow.
And that's just not right. You know, being a lawyer is a lot like any other trade or profession. When you walk out of training or out of school, you're really not ready to handle the most complicated things or the things with the highest stakes. And that needs to end. We need to have people who are adequately prepared to handle the case that they're assigned to handle. We also need to have a statewide understanding of what it means to be needy of an indigent counsel. Some of the reports I've seen describe this as, lawyers for the poorest of the poor. Well, that's just not really true. Over 80% of the defendants in the criminal justice system in the United States are represented by appointed counsel. And what the constitutional standard is if you can't afford a lawyer for the charge you face. So if a man or woman who has a good job, works locally at General Motors, is all of a sudden facing a very complicated charge, they probably can't afford a lawyer to respond to that charge. If they're accused of shoplifting, well, they probably can't afford a lawyer to respond to a shoplifting charge. It's just not that complicated.
How do you, as a central participant in the legal process here in Ingham County, make your views known to the participants in this discussion? Who do you share these views with?
Well, I originally came to this issue as a representative of the Michigan District Judges Association. The associations, again, like many professions, are the spokespeople for individual groups or individual interests. And so the Michigan District Judges Association articulates the point of view from the district judge's perspective. And over 3.5 years ago, I think, I was dispatched from that association to begin to work on the issue of indigent defense. And since then, I've been honored to be selected by Governor Snyder to serve on his Indigent Defense Advisory Commission. And continue to work on this issue with Representative McMillan, Senator Caswell, and Governor Snyder through the last 6 or 8 months. So, you know, it's because of my work with our statewide association that I've been able to begin to become educated and get involved and hopefully make a difference on this issue.
It's been great catching up with you on this one. We'll continue to watch it. I'm sure you'll continue to watch it as well. Tom Boyd is the chief judge of the 55th District Court based here in Ingham County. Thank you, Judge Boyd, for discussing Michigan's indigent defense system with us today.
Thank you for highlighting this important issue.
Current State on WKAR, many General Motors officials and workers are feeling good about the results of a closely watched annual survey. J.D. Power & Associates Quality Study came out Wednesday. It measures problems reported in new vehicles over their first 90 days on the road. Several GM brands, including GMC and Chevrolet, climbed noticeably in ratings, which reflects fewer problems reported compared to its competitors. Joining Current State to go a little deeper into the survey results, Carl Henkel, business and automotive reporter for the Detroit News, who wrote about the survey in yesterday's edition. Hi, Carl.
Mark, good morning.
What's the reputation of J.D. Power's initial quality survey? Is it considered reputable, or does it have its critics?
Oh, it's very reputable. It's considered the benchmark for studies like this. Of course, any study will have its critics, Ford being one of them in this instance. But General Motors did very well, topping both Toyota and Honda in the annual survey for the first time ever in the 27-year history of that survey. So General Motors is kind of flying high now. Of course, we all are aware of the bankruptcy that happened a few years ago, but they've rebounded nicely, and this is another testament to that rebound.
And the rebound is attributable to what? Fewer problems being reported by the drivers of new GM vehicles?
Yeah, the problems are reported by owners in their first 90 days of owning a particular vehicle. And in GM's case, they've got a really quality lineup at this point, led by their trucks, Chevy Silverado, the GMC Sierra. And those are really the driving forces behind the big gains for both GMC and for Chevy, which jumped 10 spots in this year's survey.
Here in Lansing, we manufacture the GMC Acadia, and I do notice a particular jump in the ratings for GMC. A lot of this was truck-driven, according to your interpretation.
Yes, and when you look at the GM trucks now, of course they are getting refreshed, the Silverado and the Sierra, that is, for the 2014 model year, but they've had a few years to work on the current generation, and they pretty much perfected it. So it'll be very interesting to see in 2014 what happens to those trucks if any new issues arise because of the fact that it is a new generation and there is launches, and launches tend to affect scores in this survey a bit negatively.
We make a bunch of Cadillacs in Lansing here, too, and I see Cadillac, however, dropped from 4th to 13th overall. Now, does that fall mean that GM's Cadillac division is analyzing its product or its processes? What does that mean?
Well, they had a couple launches this year, which, again, negatively affects the scores because generally when there is a launch of a new product or a refresh, there's new technology in the car, there's something different about it, and the people who may have owned a previous generation of that car come back but may have an issue or a problem with it at first. And again, this is just measuring the problems in the first 90 days, so what could be a problem in that time frame may not be a problem for the lifetime of the car.
I notice in your story you also point out that the J.D. Power survey is not an indication or not a measure of overall satisfaction. Is that what you're getting at by that comment?
Yes, it's essentially about 200 different basis points where J.D. Power will ask consumers this year via online versus mail in previous years. Here are different facets of the car. Have you had any problems with it? And so there's myriad different things that could go wrong with a car. They're sort of kind of into two groups, one being design, such as tech systems or interior design type things, and one defect, which is, if your car doesn't start. Most problems now aren't so much defect as they are design, and so while this survey isn't a measure of overall satisfaction, it's not necessarily an indication that, cars aren't living up to quality expectations either. The definition of quality is kind of shifting as we move, into a more and more tech world.
And how did U.S. automakers fare generally against foreign makers?
The U.S. makers, they made great strides this year. We talked about GM. Ford stayed flat at number 27 out of 33 on the list. Lincoln improved slightly. Most of Chrysler's brands also improved. It was a pretty good year, and considering that Toyota and Honda are generally the leaders in surveys like this, and when people think of quality, they think of those two automakers, but
okay.
The fact that GM
Carl,
helped them.
We're out of time. We're going to have to let it go there. We appreciate you joining us.
Thank you so much.
Carl Henkel is business and automotive reporter for the Detroit News. You're listening to Current State. Stay tuned for more of the program coming up. Current state on 90.5 WKAR. Everybody knows it's the summer solstice here. We're officially into summer, but it's also an interesting time to observe the moon. It was brilliant last night, and this Sunday, as it turns out, the supermoon will be happening. What is a supermoon? That is when the moon is closest to the Earth, and the appearance of the moon is more brilliant than at any other time of the year. The supermoon occurs when a full moon lines up with the Earth and the Sun at a specific point in its orbit. It's called the lunar perigee. And sky watchers will see a 14% bigger and 30% brighter moon than a typical full moon. 30% brighter. NASA scientists say the moon will be at its closest distance at 7:32 a.m. on Sunday morning, but you'll be able to see it on Saturday night too. So it will be, if it seems brighter, that's because it is. On with the show. In Jackson, conflict is escalating between public housing residents and the local housing commission board. This week, the Jackson Housing Commission Board appointed its fourth interim executive director just since March. One former interim resigned, accusing the board of creating a hostile work environment. Another was terminated after less than 3 months on the job, and still another was released from his contract this week after just 8 days. The residents say instability on the board makes them fearful for their homes. The issues even caught the attention of the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development, which threatened to pull the commission's funding. We have two guests this morning. Will Forgrave, I beg your pardon, is a reporter for MLive.com in Jackson. Hi, Will.
Hey, morning.
And Jason Smith is a filmmaker who's been documenting the issue at the request of its residents. Jason, are you there?
Yes, sir. How are you?
Welcome. Also, full disclosure, Jason Smith is also a registered candidate for mayor in Jackson. Also, before we begin, we must note that we also invited Jackson Mayor Martin Griffin to appear on Current State, but he declined our invitation. Will Forgrave, this commission has had four interim executive directors since March. What's the source of all of this instability at the top?
Well, it actually started last year, 2012, and early in 2012, February, actually, the city passed a rental registry. In doing so, they asked that all apartments within the city pay a rental registry fee, and subsequently they could keep a tab on all the apartments and then inspect them, which also carried with it a fee. And this is what they say, a way to fight blight within the city and raise property values. They tried to place that rental registry fee and the inspection fees on the Housing Commission in February. In September, the then executive director, Herman Hill, stepped forward and said, we're not paying. The HUD already provides inspections. And that's where the tension really started. And that's back in September. And then come March, he resigns, citing a hostile work environment. He appoints Kim in his stead. The Housing Commission backs him up. Appoints Kim, and then the city at this point in December also places three commissioners, one city council member, one the city manager, and another city planning commission member onto the Housing Commission board. So essentially of the five commissioners, there's three that are going to do, objectively and what the city wants. So there was a lot of tension there starting in December. He steps down. They bring up Kim Truman. The city has always alluded to the fact that there's a lot of wrongdoing between Hill and Truman, but they've never brought forth any concrete evidence up to this point. Truman was actually fired by the commission, down party lines, so to speak, the three city council members and the two original commissioners, 3-2. She was fired. They brought in another. And then HUD came forward and said they were going to pull funding. So then just this Wednesday, they brought in another. So really, at this point, there's just a lot of different angles about what's going on here. Yeah, it's very convoluted. It's very convoluted.
Jason Smith, you are being paid to document the issue at the request of the residents. We want to make that clear. But what would you add to how Will has portrayed this conflict?
Will pretty much hit the nail on the head there. There's a lot of confusion going on as to, among the residents anyway, as to what exactly the plan is moving forward, what direction everyone wants to take. And for HUD, I don't think it's an issue of them losing their homes, and the resident council boards have tried to convey that to all of the residents, that their homes aren't going anywhere. This is an issue of simply getting the okay to write checks, more or less. And so from an outside perspective looking in, it does look like there's a stacked deck against the residents, but it seems like now that HUD has brought in their regional people and discussed it with the powers that be, things are starting to fall more in step with the regulations that HUD has set forth.
Is the rental registry, is that a part of the landscape going forward? Is that here to stay?
Well, at this point, the funny thing is HUD, there's a lot of hands in the Jackson Housing Commission. The Housing Commission essentially is trying to provide subsidized housing for Jackson residents.
Okay.
That's their job. All their funding, the majority of their funding, rather, is coming from HUD. And then also the city council gets to appoint boards and commissions, or appoints commissioners, to the Jackson Housing Board. So HUD is backing them up and saying, we're not going to pay this. And that, as far as I can tell on paper, it's very difficult to talk with city council members and the city on this issue. But as far as I can tell, the city's really digging their heels in, and they're trying to get that rental registry fee paid.
But HUD is
refusing to pay that.
Who appoints the commissioner of the Jackson Housing Commission, though?
The city council.
The council,
yes.
Votes. It's not an appointee,
right,
of the mayor.
Right.
Jason? What role does Mayor Martin Griffin play in this?
Well, the city has an ordinance that basically sets the rate of pay for the executive director, and that's really the only quote unquote hand that they're supposed to have in this whole situation. As far as the mayor himself goes, he's appointed. There's a city employee that currently sits on the JHC board. His uncle is on the board, and the zoning commission board member who also sits on the JHC board, as Will alluded to earlier. So, his direct hand, I can't speculate on that. I don't want to say anything that I don't know for a fact, but it certainly on the surface looks like there's some significant stacking of that deck.
Yes, Will.
Yeah, I'd just like to point out that, it's under the recommendation of the mayor, but it is a city council vote that puts these commissioners on board. So the mayor will recommend somebody. That doesn't necessarily mean that the 7 votes on city council will pass it to that point. So a lot of times, when people are in these situations are saying the mayor is doing this, the mayor is doing that, it should be noted that all these actions are city council actions under the recommendation of the mayor. It's not as if this one person is.
Okay. We're talking with Will Forgrave of MLive, who's stationed in Jackson, and Jason Smith, a filmmaker who's been documenting the tension at the Jackson Housing Commission. The residents of one public housing complex, Reed Manor in Jackson, were very distraught over Mr. Hill's resignation and also the termination earlier this month of his successor, Kim Truman, who we've spoken about. They're very worried about their future. We've got a clip here. This is Patricia Riles, who's the president of the Reed Manor Residents Council.
We have a board, basically, in my own personal opinion, is a city council board. It is not a Jackson Housing Board, because you have 3 appointments by the mayor. We have one that is a city employee, we have one that's on the city planning board, and we have one that's the uncle of the mayor. And then we only have 2 that represent Jackson Housing. So there's no way we can ever win with anything.
Will Forgrave, can you put that comment in perspective for us?
Sure, absolutely. Back in December, the city went into closed session, and the city council then voted to place, at least in December, they placed city council member Derek Dobies, city manager Patrick Birch, and city planning commission member Gerald Montgomery on the housing commission board. And since there's 5 and they placed 3, they had a majority. Since then, in April, they removed Dobies and Birch and replaced them with a city employee, Michelle Orthaus, and the mayor's uncle and a planning commission member, James Stark.
Jason, are you working closely with the folks at the Reed Manor?
I am working very closely with them. They keep me abreast of resident council meetings. If there's any JHC board meetings that I'm not aware of, they make me aware of those, such as special meetings that come up within a 24-hour period and things of that nature. So they keep me informed as to what's going on there. I get involved and basically just kind of stand off to the side, film the meeting as a whole. If I have questions after the meeting for board members or residents, I'll ask the questions, and unfortunately, sometimes I don't get the answers I'm looking for. I'm trying to address issues from the residents' perspective, such as the JHC board president, who's a city employee, doing volunteer board work on city time, which I can't get an answer for. But on the same token, because it's a news documentary style type of situation, I've reached out to a couple of the players on the city side to get their end of the story, so I have that balance there. But the ones who did reach out to me are absolutely the Reed Manor residents.
We're down to less than a minute here. Will, where is this whole thing likely to end up? Do you have a feeling for what's next?
You know, it's really hard to say. Speaking to the residents, though, and their feelings, and my feelings, too, as a reporter, really when you boil it down at this point, you have a city council that this whole time has maintained that they're trying to increase transparency in the Jackson Housing Commission. And ironically, they're not going about it in a very transparent way. And I think that's an irony that isn't lost on the residents of Jackson, and both of Jackson and the Housing Commission.
Jason, do you concur with that? Anything you'd care to add?
I would concur with that. I mean, it's an unfortunate situation, and you know, the HUD placing the JHC on zero threshold, and so they can't spend a dime without HUD's authorization, and it's a huge mess. And you have one hand who's trying to do things their way, and another hand who actually pays the bills, and it's a toss up as to which one you want to listen to.
Will Forgrave is a reporter for MLive.com in Jackson, and Jason Smith is a filmmaker who's been documenting the issue involving tension at the Jackson Housing Commission. Will and Jason, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Current state on 90.5 WKAR and at WKAR.org. You can reach us via email at currentstate@WKAR.org. The Old Town Lansing Festival is this weekend, the Festival of the Moon tonight, Festival of the Sun on Saturday, and together they launch the second annual Lansing Beer Week. Events run through the Lansing Beer Fest on Saturday, June 29th. Beer Week is designed to spread the word about craft beers brewed in Michigan. It's the brainchild of Paul Starr, who has a Lansing-based blog called I'm a Beer Hound, and he joins us today along with Sonia Bonadono, owner and manager of Lansing's new Eagle Monk Pub and Brewery, to fill us in on the second annual Lansing Beer Week. Paul and Sonia, welcome.
Good morning.
Morning.
What prompted you, Paul, to launch Lansing Beer Week last year, and how did things go?
We really started it because why not start Lansing Beer Week?
Whose time has come is a beer week.
Grand Rapids has been doing it for it. The first one in Michigan, I think, was the Detroit Fall Beer or Detroit Beer Week, and then Grand Rapids started doing it. I was like, well, why not do one in Lansing? And my partner Steve Johnson, he does Motor City Brew Tours, and we're like, you know, let's set up some events and do Beer Week, and there's create some buzz about it. I mean, there's a lot of great bars and now breweries in Lansing, so just bring people in the places and, you know, show some cool places.
Sonia, define craft beer for us. What does craft suggest about beer?
Craft beer is made on premises, and it's made in smaller batches.
Okay.
It's a much more flavorful beer, and people really seek it out because they like the taste of beer, and they want the flavor, they want the camaraderie you get when you are at a microbrewery.
What accounts for this rising interest in craft beer? Is it the diversity of it? It's the fact that every craft brewery tastes it. It's not like a manufactured beer where you're mass produced beer where you know what you're going to get. There's just it's more exploratory. Is that it, Paul?
Yeah, because probably 10, 15 years ago, people just think of beer as all pilsners. Every stout's a Guinness. Well, there's so many styles of beer now, and it's not just about the beer. It's about like people, you know, and wanting better food too. And it's, you know, the community's great, and it's just a great time. And it's just a really cool atmosphere. And the beer is great, but there's more into it than that.
Okay. This is all getting launched here during the Festivals of the Moon and the Festival of the Sun in Old Town. Give us just an idea of what's happening.
Festival of the Sun and the Festival of the Moon is tonight, and it's featuring Bell's Brewery, and they always have a couple harder to get Bell's beer, so they always have a pretty good lineup. The Festival of the Sun, it's featuring pretty much all the West Side stuff. So they have Right Brain, and they have, you know, beer and wine there. And I'm also doing a beer food pairing. I'm running that, and it's because what I do in town right now is I do like beer food pairings. You know, pairing, you know, bacon with beer and stuff like that. So
bacon with beer.
Yeah.
You've got. Do you have something like that going on this weekend?
Yeah. It's on the 25th. Tuesday the 25th, pairing New Holland beer with bacon.
and where is that happening exactly?
Reno's East.
Reno's East, the bacon and beer pairing. That is really interesting. Some of the other events here, we got an automotive history bike and brew tour on Sunday. Sonia, do you know about that?
I do not.
Okay.
Steve knows about that.
Okay, Paul knows about that.
Yeah, so the automotive, we kind of... because Steve does in Detroit, he does a bike brewery history tour, because Detroit is really rich with brewery history. With Lansing,
sure.
Lansing isn't, but Lansing has a lot of automotive history. So he spent a lot of time working on a script, and even working with conjunction with the Rio Town Museum to get the facts right and everything. And it's going to be a cool bike ride that. It's probably like 7 to 8 mile leisurely bike ride, educational. You stop and he talks about, you know, this time in history, and then you go back to the Rio Town pub and you get, you know, a burger and a beer included in the ticket.
Do we know if there were breweries in Lansing in the past?
Yeah, there were a few. It just doesn't have the robust history that Detroit has.
Yeah. Another Monday event is the Women of Craft Beer at Midtown Beer Company in Lansing. Sonia, I presume you know something about that. Tell us about it.
I will be a part of it. Women are involved in craft beer in all phases of manufacturing, of promotion. I'm the manager and owner of Eagle Monk Pub and Brewery. My husband, Dan, is the brewer. And during Lansing Beer Week, we're also going to have brewery tours on Wednesday. On Friday, we're going to have a Czech Pilsner release. And then we'll be part of the Lansing Beer Fest on Saturday.
Have women always played a role in this craft beer movement? Or has women's role increased in that in recent years?
Well, I definitely think it's increased, but I think they were always there.
Okay.
Women have always been in business forever, and it's a business and a lot of entrepreneurship. They may have not been as visible as they are now, but they've always been a part of it.
Tell us about your operation, the Eagle Monk Pub and Brewery.
We have at least 6 beers on tap. We have a 7-barrel system, so we make our own beer, wine, and soda. We make our own pizza dough and our own sauce, so we have food along with it. And we just opened a patio yesterday. So now we have a small patio in the front.
And where are you?
We are on Westmont Hope between Snow Road and Lansing Road.
Okay.
So it's Delta Township.
Eagle Monk Pub and Brewery, and you're also unveiling the Beer Houndettes.
Yeah.
Tell us about the Beer Houndettes.
So essentially that is going to be a women's craft beer meetup group for the Lansing area. The whole idea was just to have pretty much a girl's night out. And my fiance is going to be running that, a girl's night out for craft beer, and just, you know, where I have like a rep come out and just educate them on beer and or talk about beer, ask questions. And
are women drinking more beer than in the past?
Women are, and you know, part of the reason why we have beer and wine is so that a spouse might like the wine versus the beer. And it's amazing, it's interesting to see that sometimes the spouse is the man who likes the wine and the woman who likes the beer.
Okay, yeah, I think traditionally it's been the other way around pretty clearly, I think. Now, the Lansing Beer Fest is next Saturday, the 29th, in Lansing's Rio Town Outdoor Beer Festival with 12 Michigan breweries and more than 30 craft beers. Tell us more about that.
Yeah, and we're also having Fork in the Road out there with food and Sir Pizza too. But yeah, we have a good selection of beer. We're still kind of finalizing the list right now. But our focus for this too was to have Eagle Monk and Bad Brewery, two local breweries in this, and you know, just various breweries across the state. But it's all Michigan breweries. And we're having it it's not in the street right now. It's gonna be right next to Art Alley. Is there's a vacant parking lot we're gonna set up there. And it's just a fun event where you come out and sample craft beer and probably try a lot of beers you haven't had it before.
How many craft beers are being produced in the Lansing area, greater Lansing area, let's say, right now? Do we know?
So, I mean, you have Eagle Monk, Bad Brewery, Harper's, the Barn Tavern, and Midtown Beer Company brews a few beers, too.
Okay, so that's about how many? Is that a dozen?
Probably total beers, 20, 25.
20 or 25. What made you want to get into the microbrewery business, Sonia?
It's really one of those things where Dan is a home brewer. He's homebrewed for many, many years. He wanted to open a microbrewery, and I said, okay. So it's one of those things that he had a real big passion for it. I was interested. I've always loved craft beer. I've always loved flavorful beer. And we thought this was definitely something that we could do and be successful at.
Does Michigan's brewing heritage give the craft beer movement more momentum?
Because really in, 1985, Bell's Brewery was pretty much one of the only breweries that was.
They've certainly made a name for themselves.
Yeah, I mean, Bell's is kind of like the forefathers of the craft beer movement here in Michigan. But, I mean, before, when Bell's kind of opened up, there was only, I think, a couple other ones even in the state. So really, in the last 5 years, I mean, you've seen tons of, I mean, probably last year, 15 breweries at least have opened up in Michigan, and you're probably on slate another 15 to 20. It's just booming. I think that it's kind of, we're getting back to pre-prohibition where every city that can support a local brewery is kind of doing that.
Paul Starr is the organizer of Lansing Beer Week. It's just about here, and the Lansing Beer Fest. Sonia Bonadono runs the Eagle Monk Pub and Brewery in Lansing. Thanks, Paul and Sonia.
Thank you.
Current State on WKAR. We do appreciate getting your feedback, positive, negative, or otherwise, or in between, at currentstate@wkar.org. We did get one comment who made a comment involving our discussion of Common Core a few days ago. Your guest today, whose education research you discussed, was rather uninformed, Bob writes. Teachers are not thrilled with Common Core. Schools have no money to fund expanded AP instruction, making disadvantaged students aware of AP courses will not significantly increase enrollment. We appreciate the feedback. Coming up next week on Current State, we chat with author and Flint native Gordon Young about his new book, Tear Down, Memoir of a Vanishing City. Also, the Supreme Court ruled that northern Texas could not divert water from the Red River in Oklahoma. Find out why a decision about a river out west matters to the Great Lakes. Both of those stories and more next week on Current State. Our executive producer is Peter Worf. Joel Lindstroth is the producer, thanks to Aaron Young for engineering, Emmanuel Berry, and Yensia Wong for production assistance. I'm Mark Bayshore. You've been listening to Current State on WKAR.
Support for WKAR is provided by MSU Federal Credit Union, providing credit union members with 24-hour account access online and now on your mobile internet, insured by NCUA. And by the Lansing Regional Chamber of Commerce, supporting more than 1,100 businesses in the greater Lansing area for more than 110 years. Information at lansingchamber.org.